Hello, and welcome to the reading of the Fort Dodge Messenger and the Mason City Globe Gazette for Monday, October 30th. I'm your reader, Mark John Conley. Now let's get started with some local Fort Dodge news. Our first headline reads, Hooked on Ikes. Lazy Ike Lure Show draws anglers from around Iowa. A visit to the Lazy Ike Lure Show at the Fort Dodge VFW Saturday might have had an influence on the future of at least one young fisherman. Thanks to Lazy Ike's collector, Gene Dolan of Persia, he might have sent Kai Lewis, age 11, of Fort Dodge, onto a lifetime of going to auctions, estate sales, and online auction sites in search of that special lure to complete a collection. I always keep a box of lures with me, Dolan said. I love to give them to the kids. Now he can say he's got one from Fort Dodge. Dolan got interested in a similar way to many other collectors. I was looking through my dad's tackle box, he said. It got me interested in old lures. The colorful lures, which were originally manufactured in Fort Dodge by Kotsky's Sporting Goods by hand, started in 1938. Much of the available information about the lures and the company's history is due to the effort of Randy McCurdy of Grimes. When I started collecting, I couldn't find any information on the internet. No history, McCurdy said. That changed when he started doing the work to research the company's history and many variations on the various lures the company produced over the decades. I wrote 26 articles, he said. I had details, like how many colors did they have, how many were produced. Many collection fields have a, quote, holy grail that tops the list of most desirable. It might be a rarity, a certain color or a flaw that made it desirable. With the lures, it varies. It varies from collector to collector, McCurdy said. For everyone, though, it would be finding an uncatalogued one. Leslie Zahn of Fort Dodge had the job of guarding what might actually be a holy grail for some collectors. It's a plaque owned by her boyfriend, Bruce Engler. It's what caused Bruce to start collecting, she said. The plaque is the popular Mechanic magazine's Fishing Deadly Dozen Award from May of 1962. Bruce's dad pulled it out of the dumpster, she said. Engler actually worked for the company. I saw it on the wall, he said. And continuing with local news headlines from Fort Dodge, we have this one that reads, No one injured in Sunday house fire in Webster City. Family forced from home. Dog also safe. The dateline is Webster City. A fire at 1213 Meadow Lane in Webster City forced its occupants out of the house Sunday afternoon as the building filled with smoke. The Webster City Fire Department raced to the house just west of Sunset Heights Elementary School when the call came in shortly after 2:40 p.m. A dog was still in the home when the fire was reported. The home is registered to Laver Vasquez Dominguez and Angelica Ferto Arcadio, according to the Hamilton County Assessor's online records. It's valued at $143,670, according to those records. By 2:57 p.m., the Webster City Fire Department reported that the dog was outside the residence and safe. The cause of the fire was still being investigated at press time. Our next local Fort Dodge news story has a headline that reads, Living by the Favor of God. Otebolt farmer, Army National Guard veteran, served in Vietnam and the dateline is Odebolt. Zane Johnson has led a life by the favor of God. The 77-year-old from Sac County said that he has too many coincidences to believe they are just happenstance. His union of nearly 50 years with his wife Carol is such an example. Before we met, she said she'd never marry a farmer, said Johnson. Her brother, a youth pastor, invited her to come from Chicago to a town celebration in Chiron in 1974. I thought, well, that's a girl I'd never seen before. So I invited her to sit on my 3020 tractor. We got married a year later, just shy of my 30th birthday. Soon after, we built our home here and started to add outbuildings. The couple have two children, Kim, age 46, of Phoenix, and Carmen, age 42, of Nashville, and are blessed with four grandchildren. Johnson grew up just a mile from where he lives now. My dad had 300 acres of land, as well as a few hogs and cattle, he said, but it wasn't enough for my brother Reese and I to continue to farm with him. I'd always hoped to farm with my brother someday. After high school in 1963, Johnson followed his brother Reese, who graduated in 1961, to Chicago, where they both drove truck delivering drywall. We made good money, but it was a terrible job, said Johnson. In another faith-building moment, Zane and Reese's father called in 1966 to make them aware of 450 acres for sale to the east of their farm. My brother and I bought it and came home. We bought a combine and a baler and did custom work, and we didn't look back. It was the Vietnam War era and the same year that Johnson signed up for the Army National Guard. Sioux City was the only Army National Guard still taking signups, said Johnson. Storm Lake, Ida Grove, Denison, and Cherokee were all filled up, so I grabbed the opening in Sioux City. Johnson took basic training in Missouri and then advanced infantry training in Colorado for a total of 6 months' training. From there, he attended meetings monthly while farming with his father and his brother. In April of 1968, Johnson's unit was activated and sent to Colorado. That was not a good day, said Johnson. We had bought the farm and worked it for a couple of years, which was a dream come true. And then I had to leave to go to Colorado for reasons that weren't clear. My brother and a neighbor helped Dad keep the farm going while I was gone. To this day, when I see that neighbor, I thank him for doing what he did to help Dad and my brother. Reese Johnson was in the Army National Guard as well, but his unit never got activated. After a year in Colorado, Zane Johnson was called to go to Vietnam in April of 1969. Each month, the Army would have a levee where they would call names out of people who would leave for Vietnam, said Johnson. You weren't called up by units, but by individuals. Every month, they would call names, and I wasn't called until the very last month the levee was held. After 30 days' leave, Johnson landed in Vietnam in May of 1969. I was trained to drive a personnel carrier, said Johnson, whose track was number 11. It was the same year of the moon landing, so I took shaving cream and wrote Apollo before it. It's one of the few times that Johnson, a happy farm kid, smiled at a memory he recounts from Vietnam. As the driver of a personnel carrier, Johnson hauled ammo, as well as six additional soldiers. I was responsible for driving the squad leader who sat behind me, and we could talk over the intercom, said Johnson. We were the first vehicle to leave when they'd travel. Before I got there, the two guys who were personnel carrier drivers were killed when they hit a landmine. The vehicle is designed for the driver to sit at the very front at the far left corner. When the carrier hits a mine, it blows the driver apart. At home, Johnson's mother and aunt prayed for him daily. I'm a Christian, and this is what I call the favor of God. The night before I left to be there, the protocol was changed, so tanks led first. When the tanks hit a mine, it didn't kill anybody. It just blows the tracks off the tank. Within the first 2 hours of my first day, the tank in front of me hit a mine, and that would have been me. The little farm boy I was at the time was not a fighter. I was taught to love people, but those moments make you a different person. When a mine went off, we were taught to shoot at everything in sight. Shelling and gunfire were especially prevalent at night, and drinking and drug use, prevalent throughout the Vietnam War, did not make it any easier for Johnson to get much-needed sleep. We had to stay up 4 hours a night to keep watch, behind a machine gun into the black of night. Many nights I would pull my shift, and when I'd wake the next guy, he'd either be drunk or on drugs. I'd slam his head into the pillow, and I would go back and be on duty for another 4 hours. Our medic would get high, and he was supposed to take care of us. Some guys got so messed up over there, and some of them still are today. Johnson was the exception to the drinking and drug culture. We would get a case of beer every month, said Johnson. I drank one beer on a 110-degree day when I didn't have access to fresh water, and it was the last one I ever drank. I would auction off my beer and cigarettes to the guys when they ran out. While many soldiers put in requests for early dismissal for college, Johnson had farming-related reasons to do so. I put in to go back to work the farm with my dad and brother, said Johnson. I wanted to help Dad, who owed money to the bank, Massey Ferguson and John Deere. My dad sent papers over to support my request. When I was chosen to go home, it was the happiest day of my life. Even with the go-ahead to return home, Johnson wasn't quite free and clear of danger. They put me in the back of a Jeep, said Johnson. I was exposed with only my M16 rifle for 40 miles. When I arrived, I was told I didn't have a bed to sleep in for the night. I looked out at the South China Sea, and the beach looked safe enough to sleep on. Years later, in 1992, Johnson was on a mission trip to the Philippines. We had a day off, and we were told we were going to go scuba diving in the South China Sea, said Johnson. I just started crying right there. 23 years ago, I slept next to the same sea that I was blessed enough to dive in at that time through a mission trip. It's moments like that which Johnson continues to point out as favors of God. I'm a blessed man, said Johnson. I've been a farmer most of my life, and by the will of God, I came home from Vietnam to support my family through farming and acknowledge Him who made it all happen. And now turning to some news briefs for Fort Dodge, the Kindle Young Library Spice of the Month Club. The Kindle Young Library invites you to add some spice to your life with the KYL Spice of the Month Club. We will be featuring sage starting on Friday. Samples will be available throughout the month while supplies last. This is a fun way to explore different cultures and flavors. Each month, there will be a featured herb or spice. A limited number of kits will be available each month, with a small sample, information about the spice, and a couple of recipes to try. And now turning to Fort Dodge area obituaries. First, we remember Richard Ray Peterson. Richard Ray Peterson, born November 15, 1937, and passed away October 24, age 85, died with his family at his side at Israel Family Hospice House in Ames. Visitation hours will be held at his home at Athen Woods Estate in Stratford on Saturday, November 4th, from 11 a.m. to 2 p.m. There will be a short program at 11:30, followed by a lunch at noon. His ashes will be interred in the Washington Lutheran Cemetery near Duncombe. Memorials can be directed to Athens Wood Estates. Online obituaries and notices, please visit carsonstappfuneralhome.com. Next, we remember Vincent Olson of Eagle Grove. Vincent Luverne Olson, age 96, of Eagle Grove, passed away on October 21st. The family has chosen Bowman Funeral Home to care for their needs. And now turning to some local sports news for Fort Dodge. We have this headline that reads, Mark of Consistency, 30th anniversary as state cross-country host is milestone worth celebrating. It's written by Eric Pratt of the Messenger News. The 30th anniversary won't be remembered for its ideal weather, but that's never really been the point in late October anyway. The people make the state cross-country meet work at Lakeside Golf Course inside Kennedy Park. It was true when Fort Dodge first took over as host in 1993. It's still true today. A total of 234 boys and girls team champions have been crowned during that period of time, with over 25,000 runners participating and approximately 100,000 fans watching the event over a span of three full decades. Boys, girls, small schools, big programs, followers from all across the state, and even the country. This isn't just about tradition, though. History doesn't guarantee future security. And yes, better courses and possible hosting options on paper are out there in Iowa. The Iowa High School Athletic Association and Iowa Girls High School Athletic Union are well aware. Resources aren't just inanimate objects. Countless workers and volunteers from in and around Fort Dodge brave the elements every year to fill necessary roles, from parking and transportation to finish line duties, post-meet cleanup, and everything in between. Thousands of cross-country runners and enthusiasts come to town for the two-day event. Dozens of items, often behind the scenes, are addressed before, during, and after the races. City and school leaders must all be on the same page accordingly. Being a tournament host is as much about walking the walk and checking boxes behind the scenes as the fanfare or credit received. It's a huge undertaking, top to bottom. State cross country in Fort Dodge is a great example of how an Iowa community can come together across numerous organizations, people, and interests to continually support an event for our state's high school student athletes, said Chris Quaylar, the IHSAA's communication director. The essential help comes from Fort Dodge, as this event has Fort Dodge ties and knowledge that outlasts any individual or staff member from the IHSAA or IGHSAU. It's the school district, city parks and recreation, law enforcement, the golf course, restaurants, hotels, countless volunteers that make it go. The IHSAA and IGHSAU are involved year-round in planning and execution, but it takes a community with a commitment like Fort Dodge has shown for 30 years to keep it successful. For over 50 years, this town has successfully hosted the state softball tournament, the longest-running host site for a championship in Iowa. At 30 years and counting, cross country at Lakeside now ranks behind only state football at the UNI Dome in Cedar Falls and track at Drake Stadium in Des Moines. There are no shortcuts or secret formulas to that kind of sustainability, as former Fort Dodge Senior High Athletic Director Don Miller reminded me in a conversation last fall. If there is work to be done, the state's governing bodies for athletics No, they can count on the active and competitive spirit of this community. We are very fortunate for our 30-year partnership with Fort Dodge in cross country, said Jason Esslinger, an associate director at the IGHSAU. As we see with our 50 plus years at Rogers Park for softball, the city takes a tremendous amount of pride hosting both of these state events. We are grateful for the relationship with the Fort Dodge Parks and Recreation Department, as well as many other community leaders throughout the years. They are great partners who work hard to make state cross country such a special meet. The value of being a state host extends beyond financial incentives and public recognition. This is also about community pride, a concept that often seems hokey or even antiquated in today's world. If you were involved in the state cross-country process, either directly or indirectly, this weekend, take a bow. If you weren't, consider being a part of the festivities next fall. There are always ways to help. Like any meet, every step counts. Our distance race is now 30 years long and thankfully still going strong. And continuing with local Fort Dodge sports headlines, we have this one. It reads, number 2, Iowa Western tops 14th-rated Tritons. The dateline is Council Bluffs. The 14th-ranked Iowa Central football team suffered a third consecutive loss here Saturday, falling to number 2, Iowa Western, 34-14. The Reavers clinched the ICCAC regular season title with the win and positioned themselves for a showdown with top-ranked Hutchison this coming weekend. Last year, Iowa Western topped Hutchison for the national title. Down 13-0 in the third quarter, Eli West returned a missed field goal, 86 yards for a score for the Tritons. The momentum, though, was short-lived, as Lewis Brooks and Kyrell Jordan caught touchdown passes from Hunter Watson to build the Reaver lead back up to 27-7. Spencer Zinn provided the other score for Iowa Central, capping a short drive with a 1-yard touchdown plunge. Jonathan Humpel led Iowa Western with 183 yards rushing, while Bryant Williams added 78 and Watson had 76. He also was 7 of 17 passing for 126 yards and the two scores. For the Tritons, Trevon Taylor had 69 yards passing and Justin Silverstein 47. Jalen Luth caught a 38-yard pass. Iowa Central concludes its regular season Saturday when they host Highland at noon at Dodger Stadium. And now, turning to some lifestyle brief headlines for Fort Dodge. This one reads, Elder Bridge and UDMO partner for Santa for seniors. Elder Bridge Agency on Aging and Upper Des Moines Opportunity are partnering for Santa for seniors. As the holiday season approaches, seniors in our community need support now more than ever. In some cases, seniors in our area are living on a very limited income and may not be with their family at Christmas. With the help of our community, their holiday season can be a little jollier and give them something to smile about on Christmas. Each senior that is looking to be adopted will request their needs and wants, which will include their favorite color and sizes. This information will be used when purchasing a gift. Due to confidentiality, names cannot be disclosed. However, Elder Bridge and UDMO will ensure that the specific senior and sponsor are matched. To ensure gifts reach seniors in time for Christmas, wrapped gifts should be dropped off from 7 a.m. to noon on December 8th. If you would like to adopt a senior or multiple seniors, and for information on the drop-off location, contact Karen Alcantara from UDMO at 515-576-7333 or by email at kalcantara@udmo.com. And continuing with lifestyle briefs, this one reads, Manson Watanye Vendor and Craft Show, November 4th. The Manson Watanye Club is holding a vendor and craft show from 9 a.m. to 2 p.m. November 4th at the Manson Northwest Webster High School in Manson. Lunch will be available, dine in, or carry out. And now turning to birthdays and anniversaries, Sherilyn Rapp of Fort Dodge is celebrating her 80th birthday. Sherilyn Rapp of Fort Dodge will celebrate her 80th birthday on November 8th. Cards may be sent to her at 2503 27th Avenue North in Fort Dodge, 50501. Sherilyn was born on November 8, 1943. And I think today we'll wrap up with one final news brief for Fort Dodge, with the headline reading, Salvation Army announces dates for Christmas assistance sign-up. The Salvation Army of Fort Dodge will hold Christmas assistance sign-ups next week. Anyone in need is welcome to stop by the office at 126 North 7th Street, Monday through Friday, between the hours of 9 a.m. and 3 p.m. Those applying for assistance, toys, clothing, and food will need to bring with them a photo ID, proof of residency within Webster County, for example, a piece of current mail, and Social Security cards for everyone in the household who would be receiving assistance. After signing up, those who have registered will be able to stop back by the office December 21st through the 22nd to pick up their toys, clothing, and food. Every year, the Salvation Army of Fort Dodge helps hundreds of individuals around Webster County via this program, which ensures that everyone has presents under the tree and food on the table at Christmas time. And you are listening to the reading of the Fort Dodge Messenger and the Mason City Globe Gazette on IRIS, Iowa Radio Reading Information Service for the Blind. Now let's turn to today's news for Mason City. Our first Mason City local headline reads, Everybody Plays Inclusive Playground Opens for Fun for All. A vision born years ago to build a park where children of all abilities could enjoy themselves in the Clear Lake community came to fruition Friday. The Everybody Plays Inclusive Playground was officially opened with a ribbon-cutting ceremony, and around 50 people attended despite the cold wind. The project, which Clear Lake City Administrator Scott Flory said was built with about $600,000 in private donations and almost $2 million from the city, includes specialized playground equipment and a splash pad meant to include those with disabilities. A shelter house with restrooms was also constructed at the South 15th Street location, just north and east of the public swimming pool. In this park, it truly means everybody can play, Everybody Plays committee member Christina Malsby said. In this park, the equipment is designed with all abilities in mind. Malsby presented her idea to the Clear Lake City Council about 3 years ago and formed the Everybody Plays committee. COVID-19 and fundraising challenges delayed the project until this spring and summer. The playground sits on land the city of Clear Lake bought from Cerro Gordo County that formerly housed a secondary roads shed. Across the street from the playground now sits a new apartment building and the Dancing with Roxy. Mayor Nelson Crabb said projects like the playground are important to keep a community moving forward and make a real difference in people's lives. We are gathered here to celebrate the opening of this life-changing playground And yes, I think you need to underscore life-changing, especially for these little ones, Crabb said. He thanked the Everybody Plays Committee, Dean Schneider Construction, the City Council, private contributors, and others involved for their help in getting the playground built. Something this ambitious doesn't just happen overnight, Crabb said. I'd like to say thank you to all of our partners who brought this project along. Flory said the council and the committee met on the site of the future playground 3 years ago and swiftly decided it was the perfect spot to build on. Oftentimes on projects like this, we celebrate them with a ribbon cutting, and we're looking at them at the end, and we forget about the difficulties of putting these projects together, he said. Flory added that he thinks the inclusivity and the fact that everybody can play at the park, designed by Christy King from Berglund and Cram, is something unique that hasn't been available to the community in the past. The Everybody Plays Inclusive Playground was originally intended to be built in 2021, but Malsby said it was worth the wait. It took time. You only get a chance to do it right. You only get one chance to do it right, Malsby said. I think we can all agree it doesn't get any better than this. And now turning to some statewide headlines. This one reads, Vivek Ramaswamy says college students need new Republicans. Vivek Ramaswamy says college students' new Republicans are vital to his Iowa caucus plan. The Dateline is Ames. Vivek Ramaswamy, an Ohio biotech entrepreneur running for the Republican presidential nomination, said he expects a diverse coalition of college students and first-time Republicans to power his results on caucus night in January. Ramaswamy, who has branded his campaign as a 1776 moment, and speaks about unifying voters around America First ideas, held a series of free drinks and free speeches events at colleges at college campuses this past weekend, as he hopes to engage a segment of voters who don't generally show up to caucus. Halloween revelers dressed as construction workers and founding fathers sipped on beer in a crowded Ames College bar, where Ramaswamy spoke on Friday. After making short remarks, he took questions, shook hands, and snapped photos with the mostly college-age crowd. In his campaigns, phone banking, and events, Ramaswamy said he's reached a segment of voters that don't have a history of caucusing, including college students, independents, and libertarians. A significant number of them have never participated in a caucus before, he told reporters on Friday. So, if they come out, we will deliver a mass surprise result in this state because none of them get polled. If they don't show up to caucus on January 15th, Ramaswamy cautioned his campaign may not do as well. Ramaswamy says he thinks he will do well in Iowa because he sees his campaign as more authentic than the campaigns being run by his main challengers. Former President Donald Trump is the clear frontrunner in recent Iowa polling, commanding support of around half of Iowa Republicans. Ramaswamy is trailing behind Florida Governor Ron DeSantis and former UN Ambassador Nikki Haley in polling in Iowa and other early primary states. He has taken around 5% of support in recent Iowa polls, on par with South Carolina U.S. Senator Tim Scott. In an interview after Friday's event, Ramaswamy eschewed the TV advertising that has been placed by super PACs aligned with Trump, DeSantis, and others, and said his strategy is to hold in-person events and engage voters. Ramaswamy is receiving ad support paid for by a super PAC aligned with him, American Exceptionalism PAC, though not at the same levels as Trump, DeSantis, Haley, and others. He had received $4.6 million in national ad support as of September 27th, according to Ad Impact, including $1.6 million in Iowa. We're betting on the old-fashioned approach of doing the Iowa caucus on the ground up through in-person events, much more so than just using TV advertising as a way to do it, he said. Ramaswamy, who has billed his campaign as a national revival, said younger people are looking for a sense of purpose and meaning that is not being offered by any of the other presidential candidates. At age 38, Ramaswamy is the youngest in the GOP field. If we're living in a 1776 moment, as I believe we are, I think it's going to take somebody from a different generation to lead this country forward as well, he said. In a video first reported by NBC News Friday, Ramaswamy confronted Iowa U.S. Senator Joni Ernst on recent criticism she made of his position on Israel. Ramaswamy, who has broken from the mainstream GOP in recent weeks on his reaction to the Israel-Hamas war, said he felt the need to challenge Ernst publicly to make her aware of his views, and so he could be aware of hers. Many politicians in that situation would maybe air their disagreements with somebody else behind closed doors than having it out through a respectful discussion in person, he said in an interview. I prefer respectful face-to-face discussion. Ramaswamy has said the U.S. should not provide aid to Israel without the country presenting clear objectives for its operations in Gaza, drawing criticism from fellow candidates and other GOP officials. In a New Hampshire forum this month, Ernst applauded fellow candidate North Dakota Governor Doug Burgum's criticisms of Ramaswamy and made her own critiques, according to NBC News. In a tense exchange, after a fundraiser in Iowa City, Ramaswamy told Ernst she might want to understand my Israel policy before commenting. Ernst said in the video she is not fully supportive of a ground invasion in Gaza, but that we need to, quote, pound the hell out of Hamas. Don't make assumptions about where I am either, Ernst told him. And now turning to a national headline. This one reads, abortion coverage is limited or unavailable at a quarter of large U.S. workplaces. About a quarter of large U.S. employers heavily restrict coverage of legal abortions or don't cover them at all under health plans for their workers, according to the latest Employer Health Benefits Survey by KFF. The findings demonstrate another realm beyond state laws in which access to abortion care varies widely across America since the Supreme Court overturned the constitutional right to abortion last year in Dobbs v. Jackson Women's Health Organization. More than ever, where someone works and the constraints of their health insurance can determine whether an abortion is possible. Workers without coverage are left to pay out of pocket for abortion care and related costs. In 2021, the median costs for people paying out of pocket in the first trimester were $568 for a medication abortion and $625 for an abortion procedure, according to a report from Advancing New Standards in Reproductive Health at the University of California, San Francisco. By the second trimester, the cost increased to $775 for abortion procedures. KFF's 2023 annual survey found that 10% of large employers, defined as those with at least 200 workers, don't cover legal abortion care under their largest job-based health plan. An additional 18% said legal abortions are covered only in limited circumstances, such as when a pregnancy is the result of rape or incest, or endangers a person's life or health. The share of employers that said they don't cover abortion under any circumstances is bigger than I would have expected, said Matthew Ray, an associate director at KFF, who helped conduct the survey. So far, 14 states, mostly in the South and Midwest, have enacted total abortion bans, and an additional 7 states have instituted gestational limits between 6 and 18 weeks. Abortion is legal in 24 states and the District of Columbia. Sharply divergent state abortion laws solidified in the aftermath of the Dobbs decision compound the complexity for employers with workers across multiple states, Ray said. Many large companies employ people in places with vastly different abortion policies, and their health benefits are more likely to cover dependents who may live elsewhere. Those dependents can be college kids, and college kids can be anywhere, or any other type of dependent who could just spread out over an area much larger than where you would have actual physical establishments, Ray said. The KFF survey found that about a third of large companies said they cover legal abortions in most or all circumstances. The largest companies, with at least 5,000 employees, were more likely to offer the benefit compared with smaller firms. An additional 40% said they were unsure of their coverage, perhaps because employer policies are in flux, Ray said. Employer health plans' treatment of abortion has changed little since the Dobbs decision, the survey found. Among companies that said they did not cover legally provided abortion services or covered them in limited circumstances, 3% reduced or eliminated abortion coverage. By contrast, of the large companies that generally covered abortion, 12% added or significantly expanded coverage. That's in sharp contrast to the rapidly changing laws governing abortion across the states. It's unclear whether workers at companies that don't cover abortion or heavily restrict coverage are located primarily in the states that have outlawed the procedure. The KFF survey includes information from more than 2,100 large and small companies on their health benefits and the related costs for workers. Annual premiums for family coverage rose 7% on average this year to $23,968, with employees on average contributing $6,575 toward that cost. The jump in premiums represents a notable increase compared with that of the previous year, when there was virtually no growth in those costs. Average yearly deductibles for workers were $1,735 for single coverage, a cost that was relatively unchanged. One tactic employers use is to provide separate benefits for abortion-related expenses. In response to increasingly restrictive state abortion laws and the Supreme Court's decision, large companies such as Amazon, Starbucks, Disney, Meta, and J.P. Morgan Chase, among others, announced they would pay for employees' abortion-related travel expenses. However, the KFF survey found that a small share of large employers said they provide or plan to provide workers with financial help to cover abortion-related travel expenses. Companies with at least 5,000 workers are the most likely to provide the assistance. Overall, 7% of large employees, 7% of larger employees, let me read that one more time. Overall, 7% of large employers said they provide or plan to provide financial assistance to employees who must travel out of state for abortion care. According to the Bridget Alliance, a New York-based nonprofit that helps people with logistics and defrays abortion-related costs, average travel costs now exceed $2,300. As restrictive laws proliferate, distances traveled have also increased since the Dobbs ruling, with each person on average traveling roughly 1,300 miles round trip in the first half of 2023. And now, turning to Mason City area obituaries, we first remember David Dunn. David Dunn, age 91, passed away on October 24th at Kentucky Ridge Assisted Living. Per his wishes, his body was donated to the Mayo Clinic. There will be no services. The family thanks Kentucky Ridge for the tremendous care provided to David. Memorials may be directed to the Hawkeye Harvest Food Bank, located at 122 South Adams Avenue. Online condolences may be left for the family at MajorErickSonFuneralHome.com. David Dunn was born December 27, 1931, at Story Hospital in Mason City to Charles Arthur and Helen Holbrook Dunn. On May 13, 1950, he married his high school sweetheart, Marion Elaine Falk. He worked at the Mason City Drive-In Theater, Cordell Harley-Davidson, and Armcor Drainage and Metal Products. He then spent 34 years with Lehigh Portland Cement Company, doing many jobs, including quarry foreman and storeroom clerk. Next, we remember Eldon Ernest Moulter. Eldon Ernest Moulter, age 89, passed away on Monday, June 12th, in Milwaukee, Wisconsin. Eldon was born in Mason City on February 26, 1934, to Diedrich J. Moulter and Rosa E. Tobsing Moulter. He attended Mason City schools from kindergarten through high school, graduating in 1952. He attended Mason City Junior College before serving in the United States Army in Korea from 1953 to 1955. A graveside service will be held at 10:30 a.m. Saturday, November 4th, at Elmwood St. Joseph Cemetery in Mason City, with the Reverend Sid Bowles of St. James Lutheran Church officiating. And turning back to local headlines, we have this one that just came in. It reads, Lincoln Middle School students attend Highline Trail ribbon cutting. Mason City is celebrating another accomplishment, cutting the ribbon on the south portion of the Highline Trail. Running from 19th Street South in Mason City to 1st Street Southeast, the freshly paved trail is a welcome addition to Mason City's bevy of outdoor recreation opportunities. Ribbon cuttings are festive events, but the arrival Wednesday of the Lincoln Middle School students on their Trek bikes brought whoops and cheers not typical of a city announcement. Physical education teacher Troy Rood rode along with the pack of students from 5th and 6th grades. We have a mountain biking club and a mountain biking unit in our PE curriculum for the kids, so they're pretty skilled on the bikes, he said. Joshua Mason, 3rd Ward City Council member, welcomed residents and remarked on the benefits of outdoor recreation throughout the city. Lindsay James, director of Visit Mason City, said the focus on outdoor recreation was unexpected but welcome. During the pandemic, we had to shift our marketing to feature our amazing outdoor amenities, and visitors have really responded to that, she said. In addition to the miles of trails being built and upgraded, Mason City has more than 600 acres of parks to enjoy. Park hours are 6 a.m. to 11 p.m. daily. And now turning to Dear Abby. Abby responds to three letters today. The first one has a headline that reads, Wedding plans hit snag over tipsy relatives. They write, Dear Abby, my nephew is getting married soon, and he and his father are having issues with the guest list. My brother-in-law has a few immediate family members who don't know their limit when it comes to alcohol, and my nephew is worried that if they're invited, they'll abuse the open bar and embarrass the family. My nephew doesn't want to invite these family members to his wedding. My brother-in-law says he will speak to them beforehand to warn them about their alcohol intake, but he insists he won't attend the wedding if these family members aren't invited. Neither one is budging, and what is supposed to be a happy occasion is becoming a battleground. please offer some words of advice that will work for all. And it's signed Anti-Alcohol Auntie. And Abby writes, Dear Auntie, I'll try. A wedding celebration celebrates more than just the joining of two people in matrimony. It also is the joining together of two families. Sooner or later, your nephew's wife and in-laws are going to be exposed to these relatives. Because Dad feels so strongly about them being included and is willing to talk to them about this beforehand, he should be put in charge of evicting anyone who acts out because they've had too much to drink. This solution isn't perfect, but it may diffuse the situation. Abby's second letter begins, Dear Abby, why is it, as a man who is capable of going to the symphony as well as watching The Bachelor, spending a day shooting rifles or sipping wine, having silly conversations, or those where I listen compared to providing feedback, and is an animal lover but allergic to some, I cannot attract the women I want? What do you think? And it's signed Confused in Tennessee. Abby responds, Dear Confused, so you're someone with broad interests who cannot find a broad who finds you interesting. If you start looking for candidates who enjoy the symphony and or watching The Bachelor, shooting rifles and sipping wine, enjoy conversation, and have a particular affinity for an animal to which you are not allergic, someone who thinks you are interesting and attractive. Although you listed the various interests you have, not once did you mention any qualities you would like a prospective mate to have. You might find it helpful to concentrate on that for a while. Emotional compatibility should be at the top of the list. And Abby's final letter today reads, Dear Abby, we lost our daughter to gun violence, horribly, publicly, and violently. We were the subject of news, speculation, and gossip. It was several years ago, but people still ask for details and ask intrusive questions. It drives me up the wall and hurts my heart. I still struggle with how to respond to these people. What should I say? And it's signed, Don't Want to Talk About It. And Abby replies, Dear Don't, please accept my sympathy for your tragic loss. Consider responding this way. I'm sure you mean well, but I do not want to discuss this with you now or ever. Please don't ask again. And that concludes today's reading of the Fort Dodge Messenger and the Mason City Globe Gazette for Monday, October 30th. I'm your reader, Mark John Conley. You can access a recording of today's readings on our website, iowaradioreading.org, anytime. Thanks for listening and have a great Monday.
This is Jim Ralston with an Iris short take from the Book of Iowa Curiosities. The secret is in the sauce, Cedar Rapids, Iowa. Whether he was maintaining journalistic objectivity or not, a reporter from Chicago Sun-Times once noted, searching for the best soul food in Iowa is like looking for a square dance in Harlem. Well, he obviously didn't look too hard in Cedar Rapids. Because Al and Irene's has long been the place to go in eastern Iowa for anyone seeking soul food fix. Al and Irene Quarterman claim their family barbecue sauce dates back more than 70 years. They slather it on chicken, pork, back ribs, spare ribs, beef ribs, and even turkey. And they serve it up right with a healthy dollop of coleslaw. Save some room for dessert, too. They make their own delectable pies from scratch. So where exactly did you say the square dance was in Harlem? At Al and Irene's is located east of I-380 near Blair's Ferry Road at 2020 North Town Lane, Northeast. Hours of operation are Tuesday through Saturday from 11 a.m. to 9 p.m., Sunday 11 a.m. to 5 p.m., Monday 11 a.m. to 8 p.m. For more information, call 319-393-6242. That was an excerpt from Iowa Curiosities, Quirky Characters, Roadside Oddities, and Offbeat Stuff by Eric Jones, Dan Coffey, and Barrett Torkelson.